This COE is based on New York State appellate decisions addressing criminal law that were released in June of 2020. Summaries of selected criminal law decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in June of 2020, and those summaries have since been compiled into an organized pamphlet called the June 2020 Criminal Law Update Pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which forms the written materials for this course, and the pamphlet is available by a link on the podcast page. The page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 8. It's People v. Christopher B., and it deals with the waiver of appeal. The Second Department held that the Supreme Court mischaracterized the scope of the waiver of appeal and rendering the waiver invalid. The court wrote, "The court mischaracterized the effect of the waiver on the defendant's right to appeal. In this regard, the court, after describing the function of an appellate court, concluded its explanation of the waiver by stating, quote, what all this means, though, is that this plea and the sentence I'm going to impose are final, and that higher courts will not have a chance to review it. The court went on, the improper description of the scope of the appellate rights relinquished by the waiver is refuted by precedent, where a defendant retains the right to appellate review of very selective fundamental issues, including the voluntariness of the plea and the appeal waiver, legality of the sentence, and the jurisdiction of the court. Accordingly, it was incorrect for the Supreme Court to convey to the defendant that an appellate court would have no authority to review the plea or the sentence under any circumstances. Furthermore, the record in this case does not include any clarifying language indicating that appellate review remained available for certain issues or that the right to take an appeal was retained. Although the people cite to a written waiver that was apparently signed by the defendant, the Supreme Court failed to confirm that the defendant understood the contents of the written waiver. In any event, the written waiver does not indicate that appellate review remained for certain limited issues, but rather merely stated that the sentence and conviction will be final. Next is People v. Sutton on page 9. It's another waiver of appeal case, and it deals with the unique circumstance of the judge demanding a waiver of appeal and the requirements when that happens. The Second Department held defendant's waiver of appeal was not enforceable for two reasons. One, the waiver was demanded by the judge, not the people, and two, the waiver was demanded after the guilty plea and the sentence promise. Therefore, defendant didn't receive a material benefit from the waiver. The court noted that a waiver demanded by a judge could be seen as a tool for avoiding appellate review. Therefore, the Second Department held the judge should put his or her reasons for demanding a waiver on the record. Turning to the merits, the Second Department affirmed the conviction. With respect to the waiver demanded by a judge, the court wrote, while the prosecution need not articulate any reason for including a demand for an appeal waiver in its settlement offer, where it is the court that makes the demand, the court should articulate on the record its reasons for doing so in order to dispel any concern that the court's demand is motivated solely as a means of avoiding appellate review of its decisions. Next is People v. Vernius on page 10. It's an appeals case. The depraved indifference conviction was reversed based on a weight of the evidence review. So the court deals with the required proof for depraved indifference assault. Second Department, reducing defendant's assault and reckless endangerment convictions over a dissent, held that the depraved indifference element of the charges was not supported by the weight of the evidence. The defendant's 20-month-old foster child had second and third degree burns on his legs. Mother consistently explained she heard screaming coming from the bathroom, where she saw the child trying to get out of the tub, and the child's 3-year-old sister standing outside the tub as the tub was filling up with hot water. The people tried to prove, through an expert named Yurt, that the child had been held in hot water. But there were inconsistencies in the expert's testimony. Defendant explained that she was afraid to take the child to the hospital and instead tried to treat the burns after talking to a pharmacist and going online. While the evidence in this case shows that the defendant cared much too little about the child's safety, it cannot support a finding that she didn't care at all, which is the criteria for depraved indifference in this context. Next is People v. Thomas on page 11. It's another weight of the evidence review on appeal and a reversal. Fourth Department reversed two of defendant's convictions as against the weight of the evidence. Defendant was charged with reckless endangerment first degree and menacing a police officer. It was alleged defendant fired a weapon during a foot chase. The two officers heard a gunshot, but no bullet or casing was found. The court wrote, "The jury would have had to resort to sheer speculation to find that defendant displayed or fired a weapon, much less that he fired a weapon intentionally. The officer's testimony that they heard a gunshot from some distance away does not prove beyond a reasonable doubt for purposes of the menacing charge that defendant visually displayed the weapon that discharged the shot. Nor does such testimony prove beyond a reasonable doubt for purposes of the reckless endangerment charge that the shot was fired toward the officers and thereby created a grave risk of death to them. Indeed, the second officer's testimony that he believed that defendant had shot at the officers is speculative and is contradicted by his contemporaneous statement that the gun might have discharged accidentally." So again, that's a weight of the evidence review and a reversal of two convictions under that standard. Next is People v. McCray on pages 11 and 12. It's another case dealing with appeals, this time the effect of a delay in getting the transcript. Third Department held the 14-month stenographic delay, which prevented the perfection of defendant's appeal until after his release, did not deprive him of due process of law. Defendant contested his resentence after pleading guilty to a probation violation. The court wrote, "Despite the unfortunate appellate delay, defendant has failed to establish that it resulted in prejudice so as to warrant the summary remedy he seeks. His sole argument regarding his resentence would have been equally unpersuasive had it been before us on any earlier date. Without some showing of how he has been prejudiced by this singular claim being rendered moot, we cannot conclude that defendant suffered a deprivation of due process by the delays alleged." Next is People v. Holtz on pages 12 and 13. This deals with the Fourth Department's refusal to hear an appeal of a suppression motion that did not relate to the specific burglary that defendant pled to. Fourth Department, after reversal by the Court of Appeals, held that the defendant's motion to suppress evidence seized after a street stop should have been granted and vacated defendant's guilty plea. Defendant was charged with two burglaries on different days. Defendant pled guilty to one of the burglaries in satisfaction of both. Defendant appealed the denial of the suppression motion related to the street stop. The Fourth Department did not reach the merits of the appeal because the suppression motion did not involve the offense to which defendant pled guilty. The Court of Appeals reversed, finding that the denial of the suppression motion was appealable because of its potential effect on the decision to plead guilty in satisfaction of both charges. The court wrote, "Upon remittiture, we now agree with defendant that Supreme Court erred in refusing to suppress physical evidence seized as a result of his unlawful detention. We further agree with defendant that such error was not harmless under the circumstances. We therefore reverse the judgment, vacate the plea, grant that part of the omnibus motion seeking to suppress the physical evidence seized from defendant on the street stop, and remit the matter to Supreme Court for further proceedings on the indictment." So again, this is the Fourth Department case after a reversal by the Court of Appeals, which said that despite the fact that the suppression motion did not relate to the specific burglary to which defendant pled guilty, the denial of that suppression motion was still appealable because it could have affected the decision to plead guilty in full satisfaction of all charges. Next is People v. Crum on pages 13 and 14. It's another case related to appeals. This time it deals with the need to preserve an issue, even if the issue has not yet been heard by a higher court. The First Department, affirming defendant's murder, assault, and weapon possession convictions, and affirming the denial of defendant's motion to vacate the convictions, held the issue with respect to the warrantless procurement of cell site location data was not preserved, and preservation was necessary despite the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court case requiring warrants was not decided at the time of trial. The court wrote, at trial, defendant did not preserve any claim relating to the cell site location information obtained without a warrant, and the motion court providently exercised its discretion under Criminal Procedure Law 44010 when it rejected defendant's attempt to raise this issue by way of post-conviction motion. Defendant asserts that it would have been futile for trial counsel to raise the issue because the Supreme Court of the United States had not yet decided Carpenter v. United States. A case that we assume without deciding applies here because defendant's direct appeal was pending at the time that case was decided. We conclude that defendant should not be permitted to avoid the consequences of the lack of preservation. Although Carpenter had not yet been decided and trial counsel may have reasonably declined to challenge the cell site information, defendant had the same opportunity to advocate for a change in the law as did the litigant who ultimately succeeded in doing so. In a closely related context of preservation, the Court of Appeals has expressly rejected the argument that an appellant should not be penalized for his failure to anticipate the shape of things to come. Next is People v. Rice on pages 14 and 15. It's another case dealing with appellate issues, Second Department. Holding the appeal and remitting the matter, noted that the suppression court's failure to provide the basis for its denial of defendant's suppression motion precluded determination of the appeal. The court wrote, we must hold the appeal from the judgment in abeyance and remit the matter to the Supreme Court to articulate the basis or bases for its denial of those motions, those branches of the defendant's omnibus motion, which were to suppress physical evidence and his statement to law enforcement officials. So when Supreme Court did not place its reasons for denying the suppression motion on the record, the appellate court is powerless to hear the appeal, but it can hold the appeal and send it back for further proceedings. Next is People v. Harris on pages 15 and 16, another appellate case, appellate issue, similar to the last case. The Court of Appeals, reversing Appellate Division, determined that the Appellate Division could not decide the appeal of the denial of a suppression motion on a ground, in this case it was exigent circumstances, that was not relied on by the suppression court. The court wrote, upon an appeal to an intermediate appellate court from a judgment, sentence, or order of a criminal court, such intermediate appellate court may consider and determine any question of law or issue of fact involving error or defect in the criminal court proceedings which may have adversely affected the appellant. That's Criminal Procedure Law 470.15. This provision is a legislative restriction on the appellate division's power to review issues either decided in an appellant's favor or not ruled upon by the trial court. The statute bars the appellate division from affirming a judgment, sentence, or order on a ground not decided adversely to the appellant by the trial court. This restriction applies in equal force to this court, that's the Court of Appeals, which itself has no broader review powers. Because the suppression court did not deny the motion on the ground that there were exigent circumstances, that issue was not decided adversely to defendant, and it could not be invoked by the appellate division. Accordingly, the appellate division erred in deciding that issue. Next is People v. Borsick on pages 16 and 17. It's an ineffective assistance issue brought up in a motion to vacate a conviction, a murder conviction. Fourth Department, reversing county court over a two-justice dissent, held defendant's motion to vacate his murder conviction on ineffective assistance grounds should have been granted. Defendant demonstrated that a witness was willing to testify that her boyfriend had confessed to the murder. When the witness didn't show up to testify, defense counsel did not attempt to secure her attendance. The court wrote, at the time of trial, defense counsel explicitly informed the court on the record that his strategy was to call the witness and present her exculpatory testimony. In this regard, defense counsel stated, there's one other issue that may or may not come up that has to do with the witness. The witness had a conversation with her then boyfriend, who had been the boyfriend of the victim, where the boyfriend made a tape recording of his voice, identifying his name, his date of birth, and his social security number, and indicated that he killed the victim. We agree with defendant that the failure to secure the witness's attendance was deficient conduct, and that the record discloses no tactical reason for defense counsel's actions. Next is People v. Allen on pages 17 and 18. It's another motion to vacate, this time a guilty plea on ineffective assistance grounds. Fourth Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held the initial stop of the vehicle in which defendant attempted to flee from a public housing complex parking area may not have been justified, and the defense attorney was ineffective for failing to move to suppress on that ground. The vehicle stop was based on the alleged violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1211, unsafe backing. But the statute does not apply to parking areas as opposed to parking lots. The Fourth Department held the application of the law to a parking area would not constitute an objectively reasonable mistake of law which could justify the stop. On the record before it, however, the Fourth Department could not determine whether the area in question met the statutory definition of a parking lot. The court wrote, although contentions that defense counsel was ineffective survive only to the extent that the plea bargaining process was infected by the allegedly ineffective assistance, or that defendant entered the plea because of defense counsel's allegedly poor performance, the court's consideration of the aforementioned arguments here would likely have resulted in suppression of the handgun and, concomitantly, dismissal of some or all of the indictment. We therefore conclude that defendant demonstrated that there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's error, defendant would not have pleaded guilty. Next is People v. King Hua. That's Q-I-N-G-H-U-A, Ni, N-I, on page 18. It's another ineffective assistance case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a hearing was necessary on defendant's motion to vacate his conviction based upon ineffective assistance of counsel. Defendant alleged defense counsel overstated the risk of deportation, causing defendant to reject a favorable plea offer. The court wrote, here defendant complains that his counsel overstated the immigration consequences of accepting an offer of a guilty plea to petit larceny by advising him that it would definitely result in deportation, when in fact it would only have rendered him deportable with the possibility of discretionary relief. We find that a hearing is necessary to determine whether counsel inaccurately advised defendant of the risk of deportation, and if so, whether defendant was prejudiced by the attorney's misadvice. Next is People v. Carlson on page 19. A couple of issues. It was alleged that it was error to allow a comfort dog to accompany the victim during testimony, but that issue was deemed to be unpreserved. And although the court noted that a remark by the prosecutor was improper, it was not reversible error, but the court took the time to describe the prosecutor's role in connection with prosecutorial misconduct. Fourth Department, affirming defendant's conviction, noted that allowing the adult victim to testify accompanied by a dog may have been an error, but the error was not preserved. The court also found that a remark made by the prosecutor was improper, but was not reversible error, and it took the opportunity to address prosecutorial misconduct generally. So with respect to prosecutorial misconduct, the court wrote, "We take this opportunity to remind the people that it is not enough for a prosecutor to be intent on the prosecution of the case. Granted that the prosecutor's paramount obligation is to the public, he or she must never lose sight of the fact that a defendant, as an integral member of the body politic, is entitled to a full measure of fairness. Put another way, the prosecutor's mission is not so much to convict as it is to achieve a just result. To that end, we emphasize that prosecutors play a distinctive role in the search for truth in criminal cases. As public officers, they are charged not simply with seeking convictions, but also with ensuring that justice is done. This role gives rise to special responsibilities, constitutional, statutory, ethical, and personal, to safeguard the integrity of criminal proceedings and fairness in the criminal process." Next is People v. Butler on page 20. The conviction was reversed because Brady material had been redacted by the judge. The Second Department, reversing defendant's sexual abuse convictions, held the defendant was entitled to exculpatory Brady evidence in the complainant's mental health records, which was redacted by the judge. So again, that conviction was reversed because the judge had redacted exculpatory material from the complainant's mental health records. Next is People v. Page. It's on pages 20 and 21, Court of Appeals case dealing with citizen's arrest. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Feinman, reversing the appellate division over a dissent, held that the federal marine interdiction agent with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection was not a peace officer under New York law and therefore could affect a citizen's arrest. The federal agent observed defendant driving erratically and putting other drivers in danger, so he activated his emergency lights and pulled the driver over. The agent stayed in his vehicle and called the Buffalo police. After the Buffalo police arrived, the agent left. The police found a weapon in defendant's car, and he was charged with criminal possession of a weapon. Supreme Court granted defendant's motion to suppress, and the Fourth Department affirmed. Both courts relied on People v. Williams, 4 New York 3rd 535, which held that peace officers could not make a citizen's arrest. The Court of Appeals reasoned that Williams did not control because the federal agent in this case was not a peace officer under the relevant New York statutory definitions and therefore could make a citizen's arrest. The court wrote, "Because the agent who stopped defendant in this case is not considered a federal law enforcement officer with peace officer powers pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law Section 2.10 and 2.15, he could not have improperly circumvented the jurisdictional limitations on the powers reserved for those members of law enforcement under Criminal Procedure Law 140.25, as the peace officers in Williams did. In other words, the agent's conduct here did not violate the legislature's prescribed limits on a peace officer's arrest powers because he is not, in fact, a peace officer." So again, because this U.S. Customs and Border Protection officer did not fit the definition of a peace officer under New York law, he was capable of making this valid citizen's arrest. Next is People v. Wingate on page 22. It just deals with concurrent inclusory counts. Second Department noted that the two robbery third-degree counts were concurrent inclusory counts of the two robbery second-degree counts and therefore must be dismissed. The court wrote, "The two counts of robbery in the third degree were concurrent inclusory counts of the two counts of robbery in the second degree, and it cites Criminal Procedure Law, Section 300.30, Subdivision 4. A verdict of guilt upon the greater count is deemed a dismissal of every lesser count." Again, citing Criminal Procedure Law, Section 300.40, this time Subdivision 3. Next is People v. Illis on pages 22 and 23. It deals with the proof requirements for depraved indifference. Here it was depraved indifference murder, and the second department reversed the defendant's depraved indifference murder conviction because his case was not final when the Court of Appeals case came down, changing that depraved indifference criteria. Second department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's motion to vacate his depraved indifference murder conviction should have been granted. The Court of Appeals opinion, which changed the proof requirements for depraved indifference mens rea, was issued before defendant's conviction became final. The proof at defendant's trial demonstrated defendant acted intentionally as opposed to acting with depraved indifference. The court wrote, the defendant moved pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 44010 to vacate so much of the judgment as convicted him of depraved indifference murder, arguing that in light of People v. Payne, 3 New York 3rd, 266, which was decided 15 days after this court affirmed the judgment of conviction on his direct appeal, but before his conviction became final, the evidence at trial was legally insufficient to establish that he acted with the requisite mens rea for depraved indifference murder. The Supreme Court denied the motion without a hearing, as both procedurally barred by Criminal Procedure Law 44010 and meritless. The court reasoned that the defendant's legal sufficiency argument, based on the change of the law set forth in People v. Payne, had been addressed and rejected by this court in denying defendant's motion for leave to re-argue his direct appeal. Also rejected by the Court of Appeals in denying defendant's motion for leave to appeal, and rejected by the federal court in denying the defendant's petition for a writ of habeas corpus. So this case had been through a direct appeal, a motion to re-argue the appeal, a motion for permission to appeal to the Court of Appeals, and a federal habeas corpus petition, all of which were denied. But on this motion to vacate, the second department found that the trial evidence was not legally sufficient to support the verdict of guilty of depraved indifference murder. Next is People v. Fail, that's P-F-A-I-L, on pages 23 and 24. It's basically an untimely motion to dismiss in the interest of justice, which was reversed. The second department, in an appeal by the people, held defendant's motion to dismiss the criminal mischief count in the interest of justice after a conviction by a jury should not have been granted. The motion was untimely and was not warranted on the facts. The court wrote, under the circumstances, Supreme Court should have denied the branch of defendant's motion, which was pursuant to Criminal Law 210.40, as he failed to show good cause for seeking that relief more than 45 days after his arraignment. The Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in substituting its own judgment concerning the credibility of the trial witnesses and the culpability of defendant for that of the jury. There is nothing in the record before us that marks the prosecution of this defendant as extraordinary or one which cries out for justice beyond the confines of conventional considerations. Accordingly, we reinstate the count of criminal mischief in the third degree and remit the matter for sentencing. So again, this was a motion to dismiss in the interest of justice brought after trial, and the second department reversed and sent the matter back for sentencing. Next is People v. Pelt, pages 24 and 25. It deals with the need for a Frey hearing for certain DNA evidence. Second department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, held either the DNA evidence should have been precluded or a Frey hearing should have been held for DNA evidence derived using the Forensic Statistical Tool, or FST. The court wrote, based upon the recent determinations by the Court of Appeals in People v. Foster Bay and People v. Williams, we find that it was an abuse of discretion as a matter of law for the Supreme Court to admit the FST evidence without first holding a Frey hearing, given the defendant's showing that there was an uncertainty regarding whether such proof was generally accepted in the relevant scientific community at the time of defendant's motion. We find that the error was not harmless. Without this forensic evidence, proof of the defendant's guilt was not overwhelming, as the only additional evidence linking the defendant to the weapon was the testimony of a lay witness, which was circumstantial in nature. So again, this is the DNA evidence derived by the Forensic Statistical Tool, or FST, was deemed to require a Fry hearing to determine whether the evidence was admissible. Next is People v. Churiman. On pages 25 and 26, it reversed defendant's conviction because the expert on false confessions, the defense expert, was not allowed to testify. Second Department, reversing defendant's murder conviction, held that defense false confession expert should have been allowed to testify. The defendant was 15 when arrested. He maintained his innocence for 2 hours and 45 minutes of interrogation before he confessed. The court wrote, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying the defendant's application to permit testimony from his expert witness on the issue of false confessions. We have previously determined that it cannot be said that psychological studies bearing on the reliability of a confession are, as a general matter, within the ken of the typical juror. Thus, here, the court should not have precluded the testimony of the defendant's expert witness on this ground. Further, with regard to expert testimony on the phenomenon of false confessions, in order to be admissible, the expert's proffer must be relevant to the particular defendant and interrogation before the court. Here, the report of the defendant's expert was sufficiently detailed so that it was relevant to this particular defendant, including discussing characteristics that heightened his vulnerability to manipulation in the interrogation conducted by the detectives, such as the techniques that were utilized and the improper participation of the defendant's mother during the interview. Next is People v. Ball. On pages 26 and 27, has to do with the failure to instruct the grand jury on a defense. The Court of Appeals affirmed for the reasons stated in the Fourth Department's memorandum. And in the Fourth Department case, the Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held county court properly dismissed the murder-manslaughter indictment because the grand jury was not charged with the defense of property justification defense. After decedent had twice attacked defendant inside the home, the decedent re-entered the home from the front yard and was shot by the defendant. The court wrote, if the prosecutor, this is the Fourth Department, and it was affirmed by the Court of Appeals, if the prosecutor fails to instruct the grand jury on a defense that would eliminate a needless or unfounded prosecution, the proceeding is defective, mandating dismissal of the indictment. Under the circumstances of this case, we conclude that an instruction regarding the justification defense pursuant to Penal Law Section 35.20 Subdivision 3 was warranted, and the prosecutor's failure to provide that instruction impaired the integrity of the grand jury proceeding, citing Criminal Procedure Law Section 210.35 Subdivision 5. Next is People v. Ramos on pages 27 and 28. It has to do with the defendant's desire to withdraw his guilty plea and what the role of the court is in that circumstance. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, remitting the matter to Supreme Court to allow defendant to explain his desire to withdraw his plea, held the sentencing court should not have prevented defendant from giving his reasons for wanting to withdraw the plea. The court wrote, the court convened for sentencing, at which time defense counsel stated that defendant wanted to withdraw the plea, explaining that defendant had done his own legal research and determined that the appeal waiver encompassed issues that he wanted to raise on appeal. Defense counsel asked to be relieved due to an unspecified conflict of interest. Defense counsel, speaking in hypothetical terms, argued that withdrawal of the plea may be justified if defendant did not receive meaningful representation. The court questioned defendant directly. Defendant confirmed that he wanted to withdraw his plea. The prosecutor then asked the court to inquire into defendant's grounds for the motion. Defense counsel objected, and the court ruled in defense counsel's favor, apparently on the ground that such questioning might impermissibly intrude on privileged conversations. That's something you'd have to talk to a lawyer about, the court explained, but I'm going to deny that request. The court added that defendant had executed a written appeal waiver. Defendant began to explain why he had executed the waiver, but the court stopped him from doing so, stating, "It's not your turn to talk right now." Although we agree with our dissenting colleagues that defense counsel did not take a position adverse to defendant, under the circumstances of this case, we conclude that the court erroneously deprived defendant of a reasonable opportunity to present his contentions in support of his motion to withdraw the plea. Next is People ex rel. Carroll versus Kaiser on page 28. It's a habeas corpus petition based on the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. The Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Devine, reversing Supreme Court, held the habeas corpus petition seeking the release from prison of a 68-year-old prisoner because of the danger of contracting COVID-19 should not have been granted. At the time the appeal was heard, the inmate, whose name is Muntikin, was hospitalized with COVID-19. The appeal was heard as an exception to the mootness doctrine because the situation is likely to recur. Although the petition established that Muntikin was incarcerated under conditions which could cause him serious harm, the petition did not demonstrate the prison personnel were deliberately indifferent to the risk. The prison respondents outlined the steps taken to reduce the spread of the disease. The court wrote, "Respondents came forward with the affidavit of respondent superintendent, who detailed the steps that had been taken up to that point to prevent the introduction of the novel coronavirus into the facility and reduce the risks of potential transmission. Petitioner has not demonstrated the subjective element of deliberate indifference required to establish an Eighth Amendment violation." Next is People v. Butts on pages 29 and 30. It deals with the admissibility of hearsay evidence which contradicted the sole witness against the defendant, hearsay by that witness. The Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that a hearsay statement allegedly made by the only witness, who was named Lindsay, to identify the defendant as one of the masked intruders in this home invasion murder assault burglary case, should have been allowed in evidence. Lindsay, who was shot by one of the intruders, initially claimed he could not identify anyone because they were wearing face coverings. He later identified the defendant and the others, claiming that he initially did not identify them because he was afraid. The witness who was not allowed to testify, Boyd, is Lindsay's brother. Boyd would have testified that Lindsay repeatedly told him he could not identify any of the intruders. Boyd had contacted defense counsel only after Lindsay testified, so no foundation for Boyd's testimony had been laid. The prosecutor was willing to allow Lindsay to be recalled for that purpose. The court wrote, "Once a proper foundation is laid, a party may show that an adversary's witness has, on another occasion, made oral or written statements which are inconsistent with some material part of the trial testimony for the purpose of impeaching the credibility and thereby discrediting the testimony of the witness. Since evidence of inconsistent statements is often collateral to the ultimate issue before the trier of fact and bears only upon the credibility of the witness, its admissibility is entrusted to the sound discretion of the trial judge. Indeed, it is well established that the trial courts have broad discretion to keep the proceedings within manageable limits and to curtail exploration of collateral matters. However, the trial court's discretion in this area is circumscribed by the defendant's constitutional rights to present a defense and confront his accusers. Thus, while a trial court may preclude impeachment evidence that is speculative, remote, or collateral, that rule has no application where the issue to which the evidence relates is material in the sense that it is relevant to the very issues that the trier of fact must decide. Where the truth of the matter asserted in the proffered inconsistent statement is relevant to a core factual issue of the case, its relevancy is not restricted to the issue of credibility, and its probative value is not dependent on the inconsistent statement. Under such circumstances, the right to present a defense may encompass the right to place before the trier of fact secondary forms of evidence such as hearsay. Indeed, where constitutional rights directly affecting the ascertainment of guilt are implicated, the hearsay rule may not be applied mechanistically to defeat the ends of justice. Next is People v. Sabaroff on pages 30 and 31. It is a reversal because the jury was not instructed on the intoxication defense. Second Department reversing defendant's forcible touching and sexual abuse convictions and ordering a new trial, despite defendant's having completed his sentence, held defendant was entitled to a jury instruction on the intoxication defense, and defendant was wrongly precluded from attempting to lay foundations for the admission of certain police and district attorney's office business records supporting the intoxication defense. Next is People v. Mitchell on page 31. It's a case that deals with a judge overstepping the boundaries of the judge's role. Second Department ordering a new trial held the trial judge assumed the role of the prosecutor in eliciting crucial identification testimony. The court wrote, "While a trial judge may intervene in a trial to clarify confusing testimony and facilitate the orderly and expeditious progress of the trial, the court may not take on the function or appearance of an advocate. Here the record demonstrates that after the two complainants, in response to questions by the prosecutor, were unable to positively identify the defendant as the perpetrator of the robbery, the Supreme Court improperly assumed the appearance or the function of an advocate by questioning the complainants until it elicited a positive in-court identification of the defendant from each of them. Under the circumstances, the court's decision to elicit such testimony was an improper exercise of discretion and deprived the defendant of a fair trial." Next is People v. Lang on page 33. It's a Court of Appeals case dealing with the substitution of a juror. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Garcia reversing the appellate division, held the trial judge did not make an adequate inquiry about a sitting juror's absence before substituting an alternate juror for the sitting juror, which was juror number 9. The defendant had moved for a mistrial on that ground. The court wrote, "The trial court failed to conduct the requisite reasonably thorough inquiry before substituting alternate number 1 for juror number 9. When it ordered the substitution, the court had merely stated its belief that juror number 9 had an appointment for a family member and incorrectly claimed that juror number 9 had stated during voir dire that she had a medical appointment for her son in Rochester. Not only did the court provide only limited and inaccurate reasons to support a finding of unavailability, there's nothing on the record reflecting that it made any inquiry into juror number 9's whereabouts or likelihood of appearing prior to ordering the substitution of juror number 9 with alternate number 1. On this record, the court failed to satisfy the requirement that a trial court conduct a reasonably thorough inquiry to ensure that its substitution determination is adequately informed." Next is People v. Patrizio on pages 33 and 34, this time dealing with notes from a jury. Second Department reversing defendant's conviction held the court's handling of jury notes constituted reversible error. The court wrote, "In a note marked as a court exhibit, the jury posited a question about the elements of resisting arrest. When reading that note into the record, the Supreme Court substituted the word initially in place of the word intentionally, forming a substantively different question than that posed by the jury. The court again substituted the word initially in place of the word intentionally when it read the note aloud later in the proceedings. Since there's no indication in the record that the court exhibit was shown to the parties, the court's erroneous use of a substantively different word than that used by the jury when it read the note into the record, and its repetition of that same error later in the proceedings, constituted a mode of proceedings error." Next is People versus Jones, page 35, dealing with lesser included offenses. The Second Department noted that defendant's conviction of course of sexual conduct against a child in the first degree must be vacated as a lesser included offense. The court wrote, the defendant's conviction of course of sexual conduct against a child in the first degree under Penal Law Section 130.75, Subdivision 1A, must be vacated and that count of the indictment dismissed, since that count is a lesser included offense of the crime of predatory sexual assault against a child under Penal Law Section 130.96. Next is People v. Connor on page 37, deals with a cross-examination of a police officer. First Department reversing defendant's conviction held cross-examination of a police officer about misconduct in a civil suit should have been allowed. The court wrote, the trial court erred in denying defendant's request to cross-examine a police sergeant regarding allegations of misconduct in a civil lawsuit in which it was claimed that this police sergeant and a police detective arrested the plaintiff without suspicion of criminality and lodged false charges against him. The civil complaint contained allegations of falsification specific to this officer and another officer, which bore on his credibility at trial. Next is People v. Simmons on pages 37 and 38. It has to do with prison contraband. Fourth Department reversing county court. In a full-fledged opinion by Justice Troutman, over a two-justice concurrence and a dissent, held that cocaine does not meet the statutory definition of dangerous contraband within the meaning of the offense of promoting prison contraband in the first degree. The defendant's conviction, based upon the possession of three baggies of cocaine, was reduced to promoting prison contraband in the second degree. Next is People v. Perkins on pages 38 and 39. It deals with the ability to search electronic devices without a warrant at borders. Second Department held defendant's iPad was properly searched by a Department of Homeland Security agent at JFK Airport after defendant, an airline pilot, had flown from Montreal to JFK. Based upon an investigation in Texas, the Department of Homeland Security believed defendant may have had child pornography on his iPad. Defendant was asked to provide the password after he was told the iPad would be seized if he didn't provide the password. Defendant provided the password and child pornography was found. Court wrote, because the government's interest in preventing the entry of unwanted persons and effects is at its zenith at the international border, and the expectation of privacy is less at the border than it is in the interior, border searches are generally deemed reasonable simply by virtue of the fact that they occur at the border. Thus, routine searches of the persons and effects of entrance are not subject to any requirement of reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or warrant. However, highly intrusive searches may require reasonable suspicion in light of the significance of the individual dignity and privacy interests infringed. While federal circuit courts are split as to whether reasonable suspicion or something less than that is required to justify a manual search of an electronic device for contraband at the border, no court has required a warrant or probable cause for either a manual or forensic search of an electronic device for contraband at the border. Even assuming reasonable suspicion was required here, the Department of Homeland Security agents possessed reasonable suspicion to search defendant's iPad for child pornography. Further, contrary to defendant's contention, the defendant was not coerced into entering the password to unlock his iPad in violation of his right against self-incrimination, his right to due process, or Criminal Procedure Law 60.45. The defendant, who was told that he was free to leave, was not in custody when he was asked to enter the password. The fact that the defendant's iPad would be detained if he did not enter the password did not mean that he was subjected to the coercive atmosphere of custodial confinement. Further, since the Department of Homeland Security agents had reasonable suspicion that contraband could be found on the iPad, the agents could perform a forensic search of the iPad without a warrant. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this June 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE course. The verification code is warrant to be placed on your attorney affirmation. Again, the verification code to be placed on the attorney affirmation for this June 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE course is warrant. Next is People v. Garneau on pages 39 and 40. It's a sentencing case. Fourth Department, exercising its discretion, held, although authorized and legal, defendant should not have been sentenced as a persistent felony offender. The Fourth Department reduced his sentence. The court noted that defendant had been offered a much shorter sentence as part of a plea bargain. The court wrote, despite defendant's frequent involvement with law enforcement, he has only two prior felony convictions, one in 1981 for burglary in the second degree, and one in 2002 for driving while intoxicated. Moreover, a sentence of 20 years to life is a particularly harsh penalty in light of the people's final pretrial plea offer of 6 to 9 years incarceration. Next is People v. Hyde on page 40. It's a simple case. The Fourth Department noted that consecutive periods of post-release supervision violate the penal law, and the issue did not need to be preserved. Court wrote, County Court erred in imposing consecutive periods of post-release supervision in violation of Penal Law Section 70.45, Subdivision 5C. Although defendant failed to preserve that contention for our review, the lack of preservation is of no moment inasmuch as we cannot allow an illegal sentence to stand. We therefore modify the judgment by directing that the periods of post-release supervision shall run concurrently. Next is People v. Kahn on pages 41 and 42, another sentencing case. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held, one, the judge should have analyzed the motion to vacate the conviction under Criminal Procedure Law Section 440.20 as well as 440.10. And two, the sentence for kidnapping should be concurrent with the sentence for felony murder. The court wrote, the Supreme Court erred in construing the defendant's motion as one solely pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 440.10. Rather, the motion also sought resentencing on the basis that the kidnapping sentence was unauthorized, illegally imposed, or otherwise invalid as a matter of law. That's CPL 440.20, Subdivision 1. Because it should have been made to run concurrently with the felony murder conviction under Count 3 of the indictment. The imposition of consecutive sentences for the kidnapping conviction under count 4 and the felony murder conviction under count 3 was unlawful, since the kidnapping of which defendant was convicted under count 4 also constituted the underlying felony in his murder conviction under count 3, thereby constituting a material element of that crime, citing Penal Law Section 70.25, Subdivision 2. Next is People v. Murray on pages 42, a Sex Offender Registration Act case, holding that the people's request for an upward departure should not have been granted. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the people's request for an upward departure in this SORA risk assessment proceeding should not have been granted. The court wrote, the Supreme Court should not have granted the people's request for an upward departure. A departure from the presumptive risk level is generally the exception, not the rule. Where the people seek an upward departure, they must identify an aggravating factor that tends to establish a higher likelihood of reoffense or danger to the community not adequately taken into account by the guidelines, and prove the facts in support of the aggravating factor by clear and convincing evidence. If the people do not satisfy these two requirements, the court does not have the discretion to depart from the presumptive risk level. Here the people failed to establish that the defendant's conduct was so brutal, heinous, extreme, or depraved as to amount to an aggravating factor that tends to establish a higher likelihood of reoffense or danger to the community not adequately taken into account by the guidelines. Next is People v. Kaminsky. On page 43, another Sex Offender Registration Act case, Third Department reversing County Court, held County Court's failure to request an updated recommendation from the Board of Examiners of Sex Offenders violated the correction law. Petitioner was classified a level 3 sex offender in 1996, and he filed a petition to reduce his classification to level 1. The court wrote, "The correction law requires that upon receipt of such petition to modify a sex offender's level of notification, the court shall forward a copy of the petition to the board and request an updated recommendation pertaining to the sex offender." That's Correction Law, Section 168-0, Subdivision 4. Upon such a request, the board must provide an updated recommendation, generally only after reviewing the recommendation received from the board and any relevant materials and evidence, may the court grant or deny the petition for modification. So again, the county court was reversed because the court did not request an updated recommendation from the board upon the petition for a downward modification. Next is People versus Bonucci on pages 43 and 44, another Sex Offender Registration Act case. Similar to the prior case, Second Department reversing Supreme Court determined that the failure to hold a hearing on defendant's petition to modify his risk level classification violated Correction Law Section 168-0, Subdivision 4. The court wrote, "The defendant moved pursuant to Correction Law Section 168-0, Subdivision 2, for a downward modification of his risk level classification under the Sex Offender Registration Act. Supreme Court denied defendant's petition without holding a hearing. We reverse. Since the Supreme Court failed to conduct a hearing on defendant's petition, as set forth in Correction Law Section 168-0, Subdivision 4, we reverse the order and remit the matter to Supreme Court for a hearing and thereafter a new determination of defendant's petition." Next is Golden versus the Diocese of Buffalo on pages 44 and 45. It's not a criminal case. It was an attempt to bring a public nuisance action against the diocese based on sexual abuse by priests or a priest. The Fourth Department held the complaint seeking damages and injunctive relief against the Diocese of Buffalo, New York, stemming from alleged sexual abuse by a priest, did not state a cause of action for public nuisance based on the common law or on Penal Law Section 240.45, which is criminal nuisance. The court noted that a nuisance suit in this context would conflict or compete with the classification system under the Sex Offender Registration Act, and to the extent plaintiff seeks damages, a suit pursuant to the Child Victims Act is available. So again, this public nuisance action based on the alleged sexual abuse by a priest was dismissed basically because it conflicted with the Sex Offender Registration Act. Next is People versus Mabry on pages 45 and 46. It's a street stop case dealing with the search of a backpack. Second Department, over a dissent, held the warrantless search of defendant's backpack occurred close in time to the arrest and was justified by exigent circumstances. The dissent argued there was no evidence the backpack was within the grabbable area of the defendant and no evidence there were exigent circumstances. Defendant had fallen off his bicycle after he was stopped by the police. The complainant had identified the defendant at the scene, and there were five or six officers around the defendant at the time of the search of the backpack. The court wrote, "The arrest and search of the backpack were for all practical purposes conducted at the same time and in the same place. At the time of the arrest, the backpack was on the street at the location of the arrest, could have been accessed by the defendant, and had not yet been reduced to the exclusive control of the police. The circumstances support a reasonable belief that the search of the backpack was necessary to ensure the safety of the arresting officers and the public. The police responded to and arrested the defendant for a burglary, a violent crime. In addition, the defendant was not cooperative with the police. Indeed, the defendant was arrested at the conclusion of a police chase following his flight from the police on a bicycle. Moreover, the setting of the defendant's arrest and search of the backpack was a public street. These circumstances gave rise to objective and legitimate reasons for the search of the backpack." Next is People versus Chi, or Chai, C-H-Y, on page 46. It's another warrantless search of a backpack that went the other way. The Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the warrantless search of defendant's backpack was not justified. The appeal was heard because the waiver of appeal was deemed invalid. The court wrote, Officer Musa approached the defendant, who, in response to Officer Musa's inquiry, provided his name. The defendant was carrying a backpack, and Officer Musa observed what appeared to be credit cards or identification cards in an outside mesh pocket. Officer Musa arrested the defendant for criminal trespass, handcuffed him, and removed the backpack from the defendant. Officer Musa then searched the backpack at the scene of the arrest. The court wrote, All warrantless searches presumptively are unreasonable per se, and thus, where a warrant has not been obtained, it is the people who have the burden of overcoming this presumption of unreasonableness. Even a bag within the immediate control or grabbable area of a suspect at the time of his or her arrest may not be subjected to a warrantless search incident to arrest unless the circumstances leading to the arrest support a reasonable belief that the suspect may gain possession of a weapon or be able to destroy evidence located in the bag. And the final case is People versus Light on page 47. It has to do with the requirements for a superior court information and a waiver of indictment. Third Department held, 1. The failure to include the approximate time of the offense in the superior court information was not a jurisdictional defect, and the defect was waived by the guilty plea. 2. The district attorney's failure to sign the waiver of indictment did not invalidate it. And 3. Consecutive sentences for possession of a stolen car and damage caused to a police car by the stolen car were appropriate. The court wrote, Whereas here, the approximate time of the offense is non-elemental, and the defendant makes no argument that he or she lacked notice of the precise crimes for which he or she waived prosecution by indictment, the omission of such information is a non-jurisdictional defect, and thus any challenge with respect thereto is forfeited by a guilty plea. We also note that here the approximate time of the offenses is readily ascertainable from the local court accusatory instruments. And that concludes this June 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE course.